Greetings and salutations, everyone. I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I'm the control operator for this, the Limark Technical Net. It's been going strong for over 45 years now, and every Sunday night at around 8 o'clock, we sit in front of our radios, we chat with each other, we educate each other, we learn from each other, and hopefully we entertain each other. And I thank you once again for joining me this Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we try and do this all over. Let me drop for a second, and I will give you the usual links. Okay. If you would like to reach me, my email address, I have many email addresses, but the one in particular I use for the technical net is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. If you want to contact Paul and ask him to take a look at a NASA space-related story for you and comment, his email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. Also, as always, I cut and paste interesting YouTubes and articles. We'll talk about that a little bit later. Onto a link page and publish it once a week. And so when you have nothing better to do, you can turn to the web page and hit the links and read some interesting articles. The link is roy.ac2gs.com. We offer a audio stream on the internet of the technical net. It's as you type into your browser, technet.ac2gs.com. And I used to just have it for the technical net, but I left it on the rest of the week. So you can use the same link if you want to listen into the Glen Oaks repeater and you don't have a radio on you. And as always, I like to remind people that Mike KC2NJI has a great archive site. It's called amateurradio.tv. And it has archives of the Limark Technical Net that go as far back as September of 2006. So avail yourself of the wisdom of people who have moved out of the area or, unfortunately, over the years have become silent keys. Their wisdom survives in audio form, and most of it is just as important as the day it was recorded. So consider it when you have nothing better to do. Don't go and download it and listen to it now, because the TechNet itself is on now. But if you have nothing better to do someday, just type in amateurradio.tv and pick a archive and listen to it. You'll find it very interesting. Let me drop for a second, and then I'll come back and tell you what we got planned for tonight. Okay, we have a standard operating technical net tonight. I have a bunch of little stories of what's going on in the world of artificial intelligence. It's an important topic. Some people love it, some people hate it, but it's certainly going to affect your life. So I like to keep people up to date with it, and I have a lot of stuff, little stories. And I'll ask if anyone has any comments. If they do, we will address them. Otherwise, we'll move on to the next segment, which is the main one. Questions, comments, and topics. I'll ask for people to check in. Give me their first name, their call sign, whether it's an amateur radio-related question or comment, or whether it's just generic science and technology. I would prefer for the early questions or comments to be radio. But, you know, we accept both radio and general science and technology. I would prefer the short questions to come first. If anyone has any presentations, keep them for the end of the list, because, you know, people would rather just ask their short question, get a short answer, and move on rather than, you know, sit on the line and wait for their turn to come in an hour and a half. So keep that in mind as well. So that should take us approximately to 10:15. Paul WS2N will join us for the SpaceNet report. That should take us all the way to 11 p.m. I will return to tie a bow on everything and wish you well for the coming week. So if the repeater doesn't screw up, and or I don't screw up, or my shack doesn't screw up, or I don't get thrown off of All-Star too many times, the average is about one or two per night, that's what we got planned. Let me drop for a second, and I will return and tell you a few short little stories about artificial intelligence in the news for the past week. Okay, there's a bunch of little stories, nothing particularly big. But what might be big to some people, it's more artificial intelligence adjacent than truly information about AI technology, and that, of course, is the SpaceX IPO that got published this week. Elon is valuing just the artificial intelligence portion of his stock at an ungodly $250 billion. Considering that all the AI founders for the organization quit, and he's the only one left, and he basically doesn't know much about AI, makes it odd that he's valuing it at $250 billion. So he basically said, I think earlier in the week, that he's gonna knock it down and rebuild it from scratch because it was built all wrong. So that really makes me feel that $250 billion is a reasonable price. All the prices make no sense. Why SpaceX is worth trillions of dollars when I don't think they made more than a couple of billion dollars. And when you figure out how much they've lost, there's not much to go on there. Apparently, Starlink makes some money, but Amazon is going to go into business against them. They already have 200 satellites up, and they're promising much better quality connections for less price. So he's going to get some competition. Be the only place where there's value in that IPO. So if any of your financial advisors advise you to invest, not that I'm giving any investment advice whatsoever, you might want to fire them. Anyway, so that's the IPO. Google this week had what they call an I.O. event, where they show off their new stuff. Gemini Spark is a new AI agent from Gemini. They also have new iterations, Gemini Flash and Omni are two new AI models. So that should be interesting, see how well that shows up. Of course, the legal battle was finished between Elon and Sam Altman ended up last week. Elon lost pretty much because he delayed past his statute of limitations. So, no matter what his arguments were, you can't find someone guilty after your statute of limitations has passed. Anthropic announced that it's on track to have its first profitable quarter coming up, although a lot of people have been sniffing around and they think it's a bit of financial tricks. They've deferred costs from friendly companies so that particular quarter would actually be profitable rather than at a loss again. And they've offered no suggestion of a promise that they're going to see any kind of a profitable quarter past this one. So, I think it's just a financial. I timed out again. I'm sorry. Anyway, AI executive order. I mentioned that the White House was frozen, so what's become of that, I don't know. DeepSeek slashed its prices by 75%. NVIDIA announced very weirdly that it's discovered a $200 billion market in AI CPUs, so I assume they're going to scoop that up, so that'll be interesting. Spotify and Universal Music has finalized a legal framework for AI music, so you can soon look forward to listening to a lot of soulless automaton music for other AIs. And Spotify has integrated with a company called 11 Labs. They do voice simulation technology so that they could set up something for audiobooks. So you can have some lifeless, some books read to you lifelessly by AI voices. So those are some of the many things to look forward to. If anyone has any comment on any of these things or anything about AI, you'll have a chance later on if you wish, but it's always good to ask if anyone has any comments now. So if you have any comments, feel free.
KG2RY.
Yes, David?
First of all, I want to thank you for this news report. It was very interesting and useful. And I think that artificial intelligence is the product of minds of engineering, engineering minds, not the minds of artists. Artists would probably have some other thing that they would prefer to do.
Well, I agree with you. I think, generally speaking, artists are more interested in creating their own stuff than writing something and creating something that simulates creative efforts without it being particularly creative. Because, again, generative technology that large language models use are derivative. They're not going to come out with anything that they weren't trained on. So they're kind of anti-creative. I would assume, AI programmers would not really appreciate that description of the technology, but that's the way I feel about it. And I would agree with you that, people who consider themselves artists and creators Many of them, especially graphics artists, seem to be very upset by this entire subject, especially because it was one of the first occupations that people lost their jobs over. When you could just type into a browser the description for an image and it will come up with an image, although it might have six fingers and two toes and other weird things about it, it costs a lot less than hiring a graphic artist. So I agree with you.
Thank you, Roy. Thank you very much. Have a fantastic evening, and I guess I'll call in if I have any more questions.
Okay. Very good, David. Anyone else with any comments before we move on to the main segment?
WS2N. Good evening, Roy. One comment.
Sure. Good evening, Paul. What's your comment?
In regard to these data centers that Musk wants to put up, I was wondering, powering them, he's not going to use nukes. He wants to use this. And I put into AI, you put one gigawatt data center up there. How many acres of solar panels would you need? It came up to like 2,000, so you call it 2,000. Then if you do the math on that, that's 2 miles on each side. That's just for one gigawatt. Imagine going, a panel that big, 2 miles by 2 miles. Then you put in, I don't have to put in. Elon has already said in the past he wants to get like thousands of gigawatt systems up there. Can you imagine that? 2 mile by 2 mile. You need size, maybe Rhode Island, even Connecticut, floating in space to power these things. It's ridiculous. It's not going to happen. Back to you, Rick.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. It's foolishness. It's nonsense. It's anyone who is delusional enough. I don't even at this point. I don't think he believes any of this stuff. I think this is just his. Everyone here kind of knows my general opinion of Elon, but he needs a reason why SpaceX is worth as much money as he thinks it is. The general use of rocketry is not going to generate anything close to enough money to make up for the valuation he placed in it. So he has factored in absurd things like point-to-point rockets where you'll go on a rocket in Florida and it'll take you to Los Angeles in a half hour, which is absurd. He's making up all these reasons of why you need a lot more rockets. And if he's going to launch 100 gigawatts of data stations every year, I think he's quoted some ridiculous thing like he expects his rockets to be going off at least one every hour of the day and night. And again, that's absurd. His own data station in Memphis, he only used 11% ability, and it was only something like, it was in the megawatts, it wasn't even the gigawatts. He had to rent it out to another AI company because he couldn't afford to maintain it, and he didn't really need it because Brock is not very popular. This is all farce. I understand why the bankers are going along with it because they're in for a piece of the profits. I understand why he's doing it because he's really into the profits. I don't know anyone in their right mind. The big problem as I see it, and I've heard other people talk about it, is he somehow scammed NASDAQ into including him into their averages. So every investment that you have that's indexed to NASDAQ is going to be required to buy stock in SpaceX, which I think is a travesty. So you know, if any of you people have indexed stocks on the NASDAQ, take a good look at it and consider swapping to another type of an index because there's no way that this IPO is going to be worth the money. If he gets it from people, it's going to be a financial disaster. In my little humble opinion, again, don't give financial advice. I'm just talking off the top of my head. What do I know? But it's a travesty. I really think so. And you know, eventually, when the smoke clears and the pitchforks get put away, there's going to be a lot of people writing a lot of books of how this happened.
Okay, very good, Roy. Thanks for that. Yeah, I just think of the logistics of trying to do something like this. It's just not going to happen. Wow. There you go. Maybe they could use quantum computers or something that we can, you know, that's something a little smaller where you don't need thousands of acres of solar panels of power. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, they're small. They're expensive, but they're small, and there's a lot less people interested in playing with them. So unless you want to go over to Google or, you know, a couple of companies that have a lot of money to spend playing around with things, it's very rare to bump into a quantum computer. And unfortunately, I'm starting to think that the holy grail of what a quantum computer can do is going to disappoint us all. I think at the end, it's very possible that they come up with the only good use is that it can simulate quantum state. So, you know, theoretical physicists will have a lot of fun, and most of us won't really see any particular value. You know, you're not going to go over to Apple and buy your own quantum computer, I don't think. Anyway. Anyone else with any comments or questions or topics related to AI? Okay, before we go to the main segment, I just want to add a little other thing that I was reading up about lately. We've been talking in the past about the Big Bang. There are people who don't believe it, and there are people like myself who think that it makes a lot of sense, and I don't have any better solution to the origin of the universe. At least one person brought up the fact that the James Webb Telescope has been picking up infrared signals that they think are very, very, very old galaxies that shouldn't have existed that early into the age of the universe. And we've talked about it in the past. And apparently, over the year or so, most of those objects were found not to be galaxies, and they were not found to be extra outside of our own galaxy, what they've been found for the most part. There's still a few more that have to be checked on. Are dwarf stars, brown dwarf stars within our galaxy. They run a lot cooler than suns. And so they emit only infrared. They emit the same type of frequency that the ancient galaxies at the other side of the universe are picked up on our telescope. So the telescope, so James Webb is apparently picking up brown dwarfs in the Milky Way galaxy, and that's why they don't make any sense to us. They've been misinterpreted as distant galaxies. So we'll see what the remaining objects turn out to be, but it looks like the Big Bang is still the best option. And apparently someone got their finger stuck on the push-to-talk. Anyway, I just thought I'd add that. If anyone wants to comment on that little story about brown dwarfs, feel free.
A comment?
Sure.
Wouldn't they appear to be moving with the general motion of the galactic stars in the background? If they were outside of the galaxy, would their motion tend to be different? If they're within the galaxy, wouldn't they tend to be within the same general motion of the background galactic stars? Go ahead.
Yes, and that's how they discovered that they were inside the galaxy. Their movements didn't make any sense outside of the galaxy. So by looking at their movement, and there are some YouTubes that show, I have it up on my my link page for YouTube that demonstrates that that's the exact way that they were able to figure out that it's incredibly closer. Because the problem is there's no real way of judging distances. You judge them based on a whole bunch of criteria of illumination, but also of redshift. And if you misunderstand that the redshift doesn't exist, you're just looking at a very cool object, not a burning galaxy. So that was the reason that they were able to figure it out for most of these brown dwarfs. There's a few more that they haven't been able to measure their movement pattern yet. So that's still up in a question. But that's the method that they use to discount all the recent brown dwarfs that they've mislabeled as distant galaxies.
I see. Okay. Thank you, Roy. Let me just identify. This is WA2 Victor David Henry.
Okay, very good. Any other comments before we move over to the main segment?
Comment, Wesley.
Yes, Wesley.
I'm kind of confused because redshift analysis is only one of the methods. We have a cosmic microwave background radiation. We have a distance measurement. and we have a certain summer of the processes, including redshift analysis. So if we would say that astronomy determined the age of the light from space by measuring the distance and the redshift of celestial objects, which indicates how long the light has traveled to reach us, and by that we can see the age of the bodies that emit that light, and that's why we have a redshift. If we were only to rely on one method, we would say, yes, Dr. Roy, you are absolutely right, because it is very much logic. But I don't understand how that stands among all other methods that comes to the any outcoming summary. Back to you.
Well, there's no direct way of measuring the distance of very far away stellar objects. Nearby stellar objects, you can employ parallax. And if you know what the object is, you can then catalog its qualities. So if you discern the distance using parallax to a nearby star that has a definitive illumination, you can then compare the illumination. But in the case of these things, we're thinking that they're distant galaxies when all they are brown dwarf stars. So if you have only that and you don't think it's close enough to be able to measure its parallax, then you're comparing a brown star with a galactic with a galaxy, and we don't have, there's no kind of chart that does that, because there's no extragalactic brown dwarf probably that we can even measure. Because it produces very little of a signal outside of our galaxy. It's only the ones within our galaxy that are slightly strong enough that we can pick up in extreme infrared.
Okay. Thank you very much for that explanation, but I'm kind of confused. You're talking about the parallax, and the method of parallax is a standard that candles to find how far the light has traveled. And then we have a redshift, and the redshift determines the speed of the object and its distance. So it's not the same. And then we have reference to the CMB, which would be the cosmic wave, background radiation. And thanks to that, we can understand the universe expansion and age. So it's not that we take into consideration one factor. We take many of them, and then we form the summary back to you.
West to end.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, James, what telescope is tiny dot, you know, and they see it in the infrared, so they think what it was a galaxy from, you know, at the beginning of the universe, and as the expansion of the galaxy, you know, just got more and more, the light, normal light from those galaxies, of course, they start to stretch, and they stretched all the way to the infrared. In other words, if you look, you know, you're not going to see with your eyes what the, you know, infrared is, what the James Webb is picking up, and then of course they convert that light, and we're able to see what it's looking at. So they're seeing this little tiny dot in infrared. Oh, that's probably a galaxy at the beginning of the universe. Meanwhile, all it is a teeny tiny dwarf star that happens to be giving off some infrared heat. It's so small that, you know, they think it's just a dot at the end of the universe. I guess they probably figured out, you know, that this thing, you know, due to the movement or the lack of movement in the background, that this was not a ancient galaxy that they're looking at. Back to you, Roy.
Thank you, Paul. Yeah, the point is, this is not redshift. This is misinterpreted as redshift. It's a brown dwarf, and the brown dwarf emits very, very low infrared energy. So it's not a redshift, and you can't do parallax if you assume that it's at the other end of the universe. We don't have any kind of nearby object to compare the angles. You would need the entire solar system probably, and even then that would not be enough to measure the true parallax of a galaxy at the other end of the universe. So they didn't have parallax. They misinterpreted redshift, so they misinterpreted the emissive energy of a brown dwarf as a ancient galaxy. So unfortunately, they had two criteria that they either misinterpreted or couldn't measure.
I think you got it right this time. It's absolutely at the point.
Okay, very good. I mean, like I said way back when someone brought it up, it's an interesting problem. It's not necessarily the end of the Big Bang Theory. Give people a little bit of time to take a look at things, and usually these things that seem terribly erroneous are misconceptions. So you're identifying something as something else, and that usually leads to all kinds of problems. But I'll keep you up to date if they settle the last few versions of this. There's still a couple of objects that they're not quite sure what they are, but my guess is they'll turn out to be brown dwarfs as well. Anyway, that was good. Let's go to the main segment, questions, comments, and topics. First name, call sign, whether it's amateur radio related or science and technology. Short form questions up front, long form presentations at the end. Let's begin. Get your finger ready for the push to talk button.
November 2, Zulu Charlie John, amateur radio related.
WA2, Victor David Henry, digital scope comment, amateur related.
A2NE, Sam, Hamfest related.
And 2HZN, Ham radio related, after everybody.
Okay. Leslie, Sam, John, and John. Anyone else want to put their name on the list? Someone's got their finger on the push to talk and don't want to let go. So I can still communicate. I go around you. So, save yourself the electrical bill. John, N2ZC, what can I do you for tonight? Okay, we seem to have a little problem in that John is on Echolink, and Echolink won't release until the repeater's carrier releases. So while we got this background noise, he can't get in. So, again, whoever, whatever is doing this, why don't you go someplace else and do something else? And let us have a net. John, N2ZC, are you out there?
Yeah, Roy, any time that happens, just skip over me, you know, no problem, I understand. I just wanted to, first of all, say good evening to you, good evening to the net, and I just wanted to bring to the net, I was at Dayton last weekend, first time I ever went, very nice. Had a very good time. I combined it with a trip to see my uncle up there. And while I was up there, I seen two forums, attended two forums there, and also picked up a little information that I wanted to share. The first thing I wanted to just bring to the net was something very interesting. There was a forum on a documentary of the MFJ story. Now, I wasn't on the net last week. Did anybody else bring this to the net?
No, they did not.
Okay, yeah, just something that, you know, I found interesting, and, you know, I'm just wanted to bring it out there because, again, these things can go by and you don't know it. Apparently, the owner, I believe it's Martin, and, I really forgot the last name. I'm pretty sure the first name is Martin. I know you know, Roy. But it's just real interesting. I'll give you the short version. He contacted a local guy in the area who's right by them. I think they were in Mississippi. And wanted to make like a presentation with the employees, just like a 10 or a 15 minute thing. And just something that they could look when they close down, a little film, you know, everybody talking, you know, something like what you see at weddings and all of that. And the guy was a documentary worker, and he said once he sat down with Martin, he realized it's not going to be a 15 minute project, and he's turning it into an hour and 50-minute documentary, and it was a very nice story in regards that this gentleman, young man, passed by the MFJ plant every day and never knew what it was, never paid any mind to it, and then when he found out what was going on, you know, in there, they claim, they showed us little parts of the documentary. MFJ, the owner claims that they are the largest producer of ham radio equipment. Now, I don't know if that's true or not. It's quite a claim. Maybe it is true. I don't know. But it's just something to be aware of. It's supposed to come out in by the end of the year or 2027. You know, just something, like them, hate them. They're definitely a part of our generation in ham radio. And let me just drop, and I'll come back with the next thing. Okay, and just to wrap it up, what was interesting is the owner, the gentleman Martin, was an Asian gentleman. It seems that I believe his parents were interned in the Japanese war camps here in the U.S. And seems one of his missions were to kind of be doing a diversity hiring thing. Maybe that's why they had all the problems. He might have been a little too interested in giving people jobs, trying to help out what he felt was a communities in need, under privileged, rather than on technical expertise. I don't know. They seem to have had some good guys down there knew what they're doing, and some other ones that didn't. So it was just, it was interesting. There was some comedy in there. You know, I found the, he showed the short pieces of it and everything. It was very worthwhile. Martin's wife, his children. You know, it was, to me, worthwhile. Something to keep on the plate. The other thing is, I want to bring to the net, DX Engineering has told me that they were in talks with Ultrabeam, possibly becoming a distributor. Ultrabeam is in Italy and Germany. They do have a footprint in both, and none here. And they're in talks. It's just a possibility for people like myself interested in the dynamic antennas. I think it'd be a really good thing because Stepper, you can't get them on the phone and stuff. Maybe if they had some stiffer competition, it would make everybody step up their game. So let's see what's going on with that. The last and final thing, which I'm not going to dive into, I'm going to save it for next week because I don't want to overextend my time here, is that I attended another forum, which was a mathematical explanation of tuners and how they work. And I presented the gentleman who I thought was very knowledgeable about the topic that we've been discussing about, you know, common mode and twin lead. And he gave me an explanation that satisfies me. So, again, I don't want to get into it. I know there might be some back and forth, and I know we got other people waiting. So I'll save that for next week. AT2GS, November 2, Zulu Charlie.
Okay, very good. I appreciate all the information. It was my understanding that it was patent infringements that kept Ultrabeam out of the United States. That's why they didn't have any distributor, because they were violating Step IR's patents. So either Step IR's patents have expired, or they came to agreement, or there's something going on, because that was the story that I heard years and years ago about Ultrabeam. As far as Martin, his last name is Ju, J-U-E. He's not Japanese. He's Chinese, Canton, China, he was born. So I don't know what he was doing in an internment camp for the Japanese during World War II.
Yeah, I might have had that part mixed up there. These forums, sometimes you can mishear things. I know it might have been in China that the father and mother were in a camp, or, you know, something, they were interned, or you know, maybe over here they were picked up, Chinese, something is Japanese. You know, I don't know. I'm not going to swear to that, but I know there was mention of that, and so there was a lot of social issues that seem to be, playing into this whole thing, you know, which is interesting. You know, again, they're part of our history, our legacy here. So, man, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, I am as well. It sounds like a fascinating, he's been involved in this hobby, and I do believe, when push comes to shove and he finally retired, that he had, he was king of the mountain. He sold probably a significant portion of all the equipment that amateur radio operators were using. So I think it's easy that's the case. You know, he didn't start out that way. He basically was the guy who bought up all these companies when their original manufacturer wanted to get out of the business. So he was the last guy, you know. He's probably less king of the mountain and more musical chairs. So that sounds like a fascinating thing. I'm certainly going to sit down and watch that when it becomes available.
Yeah, and that claim with him selling with the most amateur radio products, you know, it's very well, you know, when I thought about it more, I know they had a line of linears, which were extremely popular, and for many reasons, being problematic and just for being powerhouses. So, you know, when you put it all together, it very well may be, and there's like the gentleman who was not a ham radio operator said, once he sat down with him and started talking with him, he said, you know, he realized this is not going to be just like, you know, he hired him just to put together something. You know, a quick 15-minute, 10-minute thing for the employees. He realized now that's not going to be the case, and he invested so far $50,000 of his own money, and there's some sort of Southern group that also gives them some sort of funding for the documentaries, Southern funding for documentaries, some group, and they were asking, you know, for donations, etc. You know, so, you know, he definitely, he had his heart and soul into it. You know, there's nothing like anything, whether somebody's stolen a car or somebody's putting together a documentary, but it's something that you have a passion for. You know, you bring out the best in it. So, yep, we will see.
Okay, very good. I too am looking forward to it. He has a long history. You know, he's an old gentleman, but he kept his mind apparently, and so he pretty much has a significant portion of post World War II amateur radio stories to tell people. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, you know, on reflection, you know, who knows? Maybe his. You know, I think there's that Japanese-Chinese war going on then, too. Maybe the Japanese put his father, you know, in the camp. I don't know. I don't know that the father was, and I think the mother, too, were in a camp, et cetera. So there's a story. It's an interesting story there. And, like you brought up, what really intrigues me is the guy basically started from nothing. You know, just from nothing. And he used to go on the air, his wife said, just to ask ham radio operators what they wanted, what they liked, what they didn't like. He didn't really operate too much for fun. He was a guy who, you know, employees that they interviewed, you know, who lived there, they said, we go by the plant and we just keep going because we knew, you know, I understand that. Your boss is in there. It's Sunday 7 at night and the light's on. You don't want to stop in there. He's going to put you to work. So, yeah, you know, interesting guy, very productive, and the small parts that they did show from the interview seems to have had a terrific sense of humor. Very funny guy, too.
Very good. Looking forward to it. He himself, I think, was born in Mississippi. His parents come from China, and yeah, the to this day, the Chinese despise the Japanese. The Japanese don't have that long a memory, but I mean, in China there are still celebrations where they make believe they're killing Japanese soldiers, and there's a lot of second-rate video in Chinese broadcast that basically shows heroic Chinese soldiers knocking the whatever out of the Japanese soldiers. They did a lot of atrocities prior to World War II in China. There's a lot of animosity that continues into this day.
Yeah, oh yeah, no, the stories there, the forced prostitution and everything like that. Yeah, this is quite a bit. And just quickly getting to that ultra beam thing, yeah, you are right, I heard the same thing. That was the reason they didn't come here, you know, and they basically just copied Stepper, although I do know there are some differences with how they make the attachments and stuff, but you know, probably not enough to fight off an infringement claim, but maybe that is it, that the patent, or maybe they worked out a deal with Stepper. That's another story, something I'm going to keep my ears open for. So thank you again, Roy.
You're quite welcome. Thank you for participating. Always excellent things to tell me. Every time I chat with you, I learn some more new stuff. So thank you very much for that.
And likewise. So thank you.
You're quite welcome. VDH, our other John, what do you want to tell us tonight?
Okay, I'll find this as a Roy. I'll say good evening to everybody on the net. I wanted to relate a problem that came up a few years ago when at the school we switched over to digital scopes, which are sampling scopes, and with an experiment that I did, it was part of the regular experiment with an AM signal displaying the envelope of an AM signal. And it has to do with the problem of aliasing. What I did in this experiment is I had around a 4 megahertz carrier, and there was an AM signal generated by one of the Wavetech generators with 1 kilohertz modulation on it. And what I wanted to do was to display the regular AM envelope as I varied, you know, the percent modulation from zero, just a blank carrier, up to 100%. The problem that comes up, and it didn't show up with the analog scopes, but with the digital scopes, when you set the sweep speed to display the audio envelope, that is the envelope of the RF signal, which is at an audio rate, you get an aliasing effect because the scope is sampling at a rate determined by its sweep speed to show the 1 kilohertz modulation, but the RF envelope in there at 4 megahertz gets completely aliased, and what you see is garbage on the screen. It's a kind of a subtle problem because these scopes are sampling rather than doing a complete a complete analog display like we remember in the old days with an old-fashioned analog scope. So I just wanted to give a word of warning. If anybody is getting a new scope, make sure that their scope has a long enough recording length, especially if they're going to be doing things like two-tone sideband tests, or even if you're running AM, looking at the AM envelope on these scopes, it can lead to a very subtle kind of problem. Go ahead.
Okay, very good, John. Thank you for that. I think you actually brought that up once before on the technical net a few years ago.
I might have, and if I did, I apologize for it. It's just one of those things that comes back and bites me in certain places that I might have brought it up, but it was really an eye opener to me when this happened. If I did mention it before, sorry for the repetition.
It's no problem, John. It's not like everyone listens every week, so I'm sure there are more than a few people who missed that particular technical net that picked it up now. So I thank you for your participation, as always. Okay, Sam, I hope you're still out there. What do you got for us tonight?
Okay, this is K2NE, Sam in Park Slope, and well, two things. Regarding Dayton, as you know, I'm taking the CW Academy course, the intermediate level of CW operation, and the head of the CW Academy, who happens to be the mentor in our group of six trainees, gave the head of speech at Dayton on CW Academy, and he taped it, and he shared the tape of his presentation, and it was absolutely fascinating to learn the history of CW Academy and their techniques and their purposes and whatever. So just referring to Dayton for a moment, that was a very interesting presentation, which I actually made try to share at the Kings County Radio Club one meeting when there's no special speaker. Going to where I'm at, I was just curious, you know, I'm a new member of Limark, and I know there's a Limark Outdoor Ham Fest coming up in early June, and I was just wondering if anyone could describe it based on the past. You know, I'd like to know how it's set up and what types of things they're offering. So if other people on the net have gone to the Ham Fest in June, maybe they can relate some information about it. That's it, Roy. I'm standing by.
Okay, very good. That's the outdoor get-together that they have during springtime. Anyone care to tell Sam what it's about and what it's like? Come on, don't be shy. I'm sure there's more than a few people who've attended more than half a dozen of those outside get-togethers. That's disappointing. I can't believe there's no one out there who attended it. I attended it. I did, I think, one of my last 3D modeling presentations on a June get-together, a little hamvention and whatever. Sure no one has any interesting stories to tell about this particular get-together that this club does every year?
November 2, Zulu Charlie.
Yeah, John.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't... It's my hearing right now. I didn't have the hearing aided. I didn't hear. I know. Was he talking about a ham fest, or was he talking about the annual Ham Radio University? What was the question?
He's talking about the Limark Ham Fest. In June, they have an outdoors ham fest.
Okay. He just wanted to know what it was like. Was that it?
Yeah. That's what I gather.
Yeah, I attended a few of them, and, you know, we spent, in my opinion, a cut above, you know, all the other ham radio clubs. That's just my opinion. I don't want to go on another repeater and say that, but the Ham Fest reflected that. There was always a good line of vendors. You know, one thing I noticed with Dayton, just, you know, you go back into years past, and, you know, I remember the ones in Flushing Meadow Park. You had the Hall of Science club there having their Ham Fest, and, you know, they were pretty much the same. They were pretty much the same. Some are bigger, some have more vendors. That seems to be the difference, you know, bigger and more vendors, and Limark always had a lot of vendors there. The odd and end parts that we used to all search for, both the clientele and the people selling them, you know, slowly disappearing. It's kind of sad. You go there now and you see some of the old timers selling these. I don't know, almost they're not World War II surplus, but just like old radios and stuff that really. In today's day and age, nobody wants anymore. It's a throwaway society. So, you know, that part's changed. But, you know, I always found I enjoyed the Ham Radio University more, the camaraderie, just because, you know, it's more conducive to meeting people and the forums, et cetera, and it goes on, and you're rushing back and forth. You take the break for lunch. Everybody's having lunch together. But it's the same thing at the regular Ham Fest. You're always going to meet people. Always, you know, great bunch of guys and conversations and a couple of memories, you know, that you're going to take away with you.
Okay, very good, John. I appreciate it. Yeah, it's kind of like the indoor Ham Fest, except it's a nice little parky type of a place with grass on the ground, and you get to touch the grass. And there's not as many sellers as there used to be, as John mentioned. Over the years, gentlemen retire, they move away, they fold the business. You don't really get that many magic bargains. The old equipment just keeps getting older. You know, Sussex has a much larger collection of old pre- and post-World War II type of electronics. But, you know, it's a friendly little